You may have experienced a bit of deja vu yesterday as we marked another holiday in Houston with street flooding. While we didn't see flooding to the extent of the Tax Day or Memorial Day floods and certainly nothing like Harvey, we got a sort of test run that reinforced some progress made since last August and some work still to be done. I'm Craig Cohen. Next on Houston Matters, experts weigh in on how far we've come since Harvey and how far we still have to go to mitigate future floods. Also this hour, we welcome your astronomy questions for James Wooten, the planetarium astronomer at the Houston Museum of Natural Science. Anything you want to know about the night sky is welcome at talk@houstonmatters.org. Plus, what we can learn from hours of digitized audio from Mission Control during the Apollo moon missions. And writer W.F. Strong has a new book out highlighting some of his favorite stories from Texas. These and other Houston Matters follow this hour's news. This is Houston Matters. I'm Craig Cohen. Houston marked another holiday with street flooding. While yesterday was not as severe as the Tax Day or Memorial Day floods, it's a reminder of how quickly our region can become waterlogged. In an afternoon press conference, Houston Mayor Sylvester Turner said the city was prepared for potential flooding.
We have more assets than we did during Harvey, a lot more assets that are readily available. And so we had about 12 high water trucks positioned throughout the city, about 43 boats positioned throughout the city.
Mayor Turner, an audio courtesy of KTRK. Earlier in the day, Harris County Judge Ed Emmett said the flooding was a reminder of the need for better flood prevention.
We basically recovered, but if you say, are we better prepared, then no, because we've got major projects that need to be done, and they need to be done quickly.
Judge Emmett, an audio courtesy of KPRC. So how prepared were we? How far have we come since Harvey? Houston Matters' Maggie Martin asked Sam Brody, director of the Center for Texas Beaches and Shores at Texas A&M University at Galveston.
I think we're still rebounding off of Hurricane Harvey, and because of that, the decision makers and the media and residents were more acutely aware of flood problems. And so from that perspective, I think we did pretty well. I think yesterday was, however, a warning that we still have some real deep-seated urban flood problems that we have to address.
What are those problems, Sam?
Well, you know, it's a mixed picture. The city has done some really bold, innovative things in response to Hurricane Harvey. One of those is increasing the required elevation standards for structures, new structures built. There's a lot of projects in the pipeline, but I think there's low-hanging fruit that we could address immediately that will prevent impact in the short term. And that those are around risk communication. I really think that better communicating risk of flooding and where the flooding is occurring, the city can do a lot more in that area. And while the long-term projects and regulations take hold, these short-term, low-hanging fruit options, I think, can really make a difference.
In terms of communication, what are some ways, just off the top of your head, of ways that you think county and city officials could better communicate to residents?
Well, from the city perspective, and we're just talking about this, every time this happens, I wonder why Houston doesn't have a comprehensive flood warning system linked to automatic gate closures to identify and prevent motorists from driving into flooded waters. And I asked that question last year, and one response was, well, the technology doesn't exist. And my response was, then let's create it and let's be leaders. Another response was, it's too expensive. But when you're sitting at an intersection wondering whether that puddle is 2 inches deep or 4 feet deep, I think that's worth investing in, because that the terror of sitting there waiting while everyone behind you is waiting on the roadway is something that I think everyone wants to avoid.
But I guess to play devil's advocate, city officials might counter saying, well, we told people, you know, don't go on the roads in the first place. And they would probably argue we gave everybody adequate warning that there would be this severe weather coming and to be alert, and especially to road conditions. What would you say in response if they made that argument?
I think that that's true, that the messages went out in some limited venues. But if you're driving to the grocery store to prepare for the 4th of July celebration yesterday, And the weather says, well, we're going to get some thunderstorms and 1 to 2 inches, some locally heavy rains. When I read that, that didn't deter me, and I know better because it didn't seem like that was a big deal. And we weren't ready for 4 inches an hour of rainfall that flooded many different streets. But if we had a system in place, like Austin and other cities around the country, that a motorist didn't have to wait for a message over the TV or the internet, but it's real time as they're driving, and they have a cell phone or their navigation system is hooked up to a centralized computer system, and as they get to an intersection, they're notified that, hey, there is high water here, or there's a flashing signal, or there's a gate that closes. And I think a lot of people yesterday, perhaps tens or hundreds of thousands of people on the roadway, would have appreciated a system like that. And it's been discussed and batted around. I just think that's an easy way to start investing short-term, while some of our longer-term solutions that will take years to implement take hold in terms of reducing flood damage.
To that point, until we have technology like that, do you think there is some onus on the individual themselves to take precautions? We talk a lot about, of course, what the city and county can be doing to improve flood mitigation efforts in general. But is there a point at which the onus could also be on the public to take some responsibility or to take some precautions themselves as these events occur?
Absolutely. I think at the end of the day, it's the individual homeowner or resident that is most responsible for protecting themselves and their family. But we still need to provide important cues on what needs to be done, when it needs to be done. And I think that's the role of our government services to do that. But I do think that individuals need to better understand what their risk is and what they can do about it. If I can offer a professorly public service announcement, that is to go outside to your streets, and if you have street drains, make sure they're unclogged, because yesterday a lot of debris, there was a lot of silt that came with the floodwaters in the streets that have clogged a lot of the drains, and we want to keep those clean in preparation for the next storm, which will certainly come one of these days. And I think the city can't maintain and clean every drain. That should be an individual homeowner's responsibility. So go outside. If you have a street drain, check it out. If it's clogged, sweep it out. Because I think that, in terms of local ponding and local flooding, goes a long way.
That's Sam Brody, director of the Center for Texas Beaches and Shores at Texas A&M University at Galveston. He spoke with Houston Matters' Maggie Martin this morning. Joining me now is Christoph Spieler, project manager for the Greater Houston Flood Mitigation Consortium. Christoph, welcome back to the program.
Happy to be here.
What's your main takeaway from yesterday?
To me, it really pointed out the importance of local drainage, that when we talk about flooding, we often really focus on the major bayous and think about flooding as water is rising out of a bayou and flooding homes. That really didn't happen yesterday. The bayous generally stayed within their banks. What we saw was water trying to make its way to a bayou and flooding streets and cars and homes on the way there. And I don't think that has gotten nearly enough focus. And especially in older neighborhoods, a lot of those local drainage networks don't work very well.
Sam Brody stresses homeowners should help unclog street drains. Do you agree it's on all of us to do that sort of thing?
Definitely. There's a lot of small-scale things that homeowners can help with. And it's street drains, it's ditches, it's even how water drains on individual properties. Does it drain away from the house or towards it? But I think he's also correct. There is some of this that can only be done by government. And I think some of that's happening. You see the city of Houston doing a lot of local upgrades. You see building regulations and development regulations are much better on this. So the post-1980s neighborhoods have done much better. But I also think there's a potential to do a lot of things we're not doing. And I don't think there's been a real focus on going back into these older neighborhoods and finding a way to retrofit more effective local drainage.
How much progress would you say we've made since Harvey?
I mean, I think a lot of these kind of things take a very long time to do. The time to ask whether we learned lessons from Harvey isn't now. It's probably 10 years from now, which really points to me one of the biggest things I hope everybody's taken away from Harvey is we can't stop focusing on this issue. This is going to be a long, difficult, protracted effort to make this region more resilient to flooding. We can totally do it. I mean, we will never get rid of flooding in Houston, but I think we can significantly reduce its impacts. But we can do that only if we have the attention span to keep focusing on this, not a year after a flood event, but 2 years, 5 years, a decade after a flood event, and really follow through on all these discussions we're having right now.
What's the responsible attentiveness to how not just a question of how attentive should we be, but how should that manifest itself the next time that there's a lot of rain falling? Should we freak out? I mean, I think I saw a little bit of that yesterday. I saw a little bit of that sort of blithe lack of awareness. People kind of ran the gamut yesterday.
I mean, I would really hope that everybody thinks through what's the next time a storm like this comes. What do I need to do to be prepared? What's my personal plan? I mean, I totally understand people freaking out, especially people who really suffer during Harvey. That is, I'm seeing that kind of PTSD after a storm. I kind of wish we'd freak out more when the rain isn't falling. That we would think about this more when the sky is blue and everything's happy.
Christoph Spieler is project manager for the Greater Houston Flood Mitigation Consortium. Christoph, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Just ahead, we turn from the streets to the night sky as we learn about efforts to preserve audio from the Apollo moon missions. And later, we welcome your stargazing questions for an area astronomer. Stay with us as Houston Matters continues. This is Houston Matters. I'm Craig Cohen. Later this hour, we'll welcome your questions about the night sky for James Wooten, planetarium astronomer at the Houston Museum of Natural Science. You can email your questions now to talk@houstonmatters.org, or if you don't mind hanging on the line for a bit, call us now at 713-440-8870. Curiosity about outer space, with an assist from the Cold War and a challenge from President Kennedy, helped propel what became the Apollo moon missions. Now we can listen to how those missions played out moment by moment, thanks to researchers who have digitized thousands of hours of audio tapes from NASA's archives. They're recordings of all the workers in mission control and their support crews communicating with each other and with the Apollo astronauts. NASA had the audio on large format tapes among 30 different tracks recorded during the missions. Dr. John Hansen led the UT research team preserving the audio. Back in January, he told Houston Matters' Michael Haggerty via Skype why his team was interested in it.
Tranquility Base here. The Eagle has landed.
Roger, Tranquility. We copy you on the ground. You got a bunch of guys about to turn blue. We're breathing again. Thanks a lot.
So we knew NASA had a fair amount of audio available from Apollo 11, or at least some of the Apollo missions. When we put in this proposal to the National Science Foundation, the goal was actually to look at how could we analyze audio in naturalistic settings where people were trying to solve some major problem. And so we felt, well, NASA and Apollo would be a good example because everyone worked together to try and accomplish things. We also knew that it was recorded. So there were actually two tape recorders or systems called SoundScriber, each picking up 30 tracks. And so you would have as much as 60 tracks that were actually being recorded at any one time. And so how did we discover this? Well, when we went down to NASA, we had expected them just to give us all the data. We thought that they had digitized it all. And by the time we went down, they basically just pointed to the SoundScriber system and said, well, there's the system. It'll play it back for you. You know, whatever you need to pull off audio-wise, we'll get you access to the analog tapes.
And this thing, the SoundScriber, I should say, is kind of enormous, bigger than a person, right?
Yeah, it takes up kind of maybe a third of a room. It's really large. It was built in the 1960s. So this is really the only system that's left in the world that actually will play this back. So if you mess this up, realistically, you're not getting any of the audio off any of these tapes. It's just not possible because we don't have a system to play them back. So reality hit where we needed to kind of come up with a mechanism to try and pull the audio off.
And it's important to note, too, that you're dealing with an incredible volume of material here. In addition to hours and hours of tapes across numerous missions, you also have 30 tracks on each tape. So if you multiply the number of tracks by the length of tape times the number of tapes, it would take you an eternity to dub all this audio. How did you figure out a way to do it faster?
Yeah, so that was one of the challenges when we talked with NASA. If we were just looking at Apollo 11 and we were going to try to just digitize Apollo 11, the system that they had, SoundScriber, could only play back one track at a time. So we literally have to take every tape, which has 14 hours worth of audio, run that 30 times to pull each track off. Then we'd have to figure out how to synchronize all those after we digitize it. So that's not an easy task. But if you were just doing that, it would take you about 170 years to digitize just Apollo 11 if you were doing it 24/7. So it's really not possible to get that done. And so we talked with NASA and we said, look, we need to make some modifications on the machine. Are you okay with this? And they said, well, sure, but you're going to have to kind of pay for it yourself. And we said, well, we're fine to do that. So we came up with a new design for reading audio off of the tapes. There's a 30-track read head. And we designed it. We had it built here in the U.S. And so my students, three of my students, worked together to try and come up with a hardware configuration that would allow us to use the existing tape unit, but be able to pull all of the audio off from this 30-track read head, feed it simultaneously into a system that would allow us to digitize all 30 tracks at the exact same time. And by doing that, we were able to get four missions totaling 19,000 hours digitized in roughly about 3 months.
Once you got all this material digitized, what did you find? I'm sure a lot of it could be routine or filled with a ton of jargon that doesn't necessarily mean a lot to the average person, but what's on there that maybe the rest of us might find interesting?
You always get some very interesting things that come in there. So let me say, for the first part, the astronauts are not awake for, 6 to 8 days. So they have to sleep during that time. And so when they're asleep, it's kind of downtime. There's not as much activity going on during the day. Well, each of the people working in NASA and Mission Control, they, of course, also can't work, 6 to 8 days straight. So there's actually three people that sit in each seat and they take turns every 8 hours changing position, so to speak. We got some interesting things. Certainly not necessarily in Apollo 11, a lot of emergencies, but there were certainly some events that took place that they had to address, emergency sensors or things that popped up.
Give us a reading on the 1202 program alarm. We're going
Roger.
That flight.
We're going that alarm?
Roger, we got you. We're going
if
that alarm.
If it doesn't reoccur, we'll be go. He's taking it off H now.
Roger.
I'll give you one little example that was an interesting, human interest type thing. When Apollo 11 landed on the moon, there were several hours that were going to take place between when, the Eagle has landed to when they actually walk on the moon. So several of the mission, maybe, 5-6 hours, something like this. And so one of the mission specialists in Mission Control decides, well, I've got some time off before we're going to walk on the moon. I need to eat. He calls up his girlfriend and basically arranges to kind of meet at a restaurant. And now no one had a cell phone at the time, so when he's talking on the phone, all that got recorded on the official Apollo stuff.
That's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
And we asked NASA, are you okay with this? And they said, yeah. I mean, it actually shows that the person is human. When we made this release over the last, a couple of weeks here, I have actually gotten a few people contacting me saying, one person contacted me saying their father-in-law was actually one of the mission specialists there, and had another person contact me saying that he was responsible for the fuel aspects there. We're pulling all of this audio off to help NASA, also for preservation, but also in the speech and language community. If you think of all the technologies that use, speech, you think of all your smartphones, think of commercial applications like Amazon, Apple, Microsoft, Google, any of the companies that are making speech technologies, there really isn't a large collection of audio that's publicly available. Each of these companies will actually collect, like Google, for example, has lots of audio, but they want to hold on to that. They're not going to share it with their competitors. So in the academic world, there isn't a large audio collection of real data. of people working together. And this is really the first one that's available. So this is going to be made available to the entire community of people that do research and technology. It'll also be made available for anyone that is interested in STEM education. So if you're looking at history and trying to kind of explore these things. And the last one I will kind of mention is I use the concept, we think of the heroes being the astronauts. They sacrificed or put their lives at risk to kind of accomplish this mission. But if you think of all the people behind the scenes, the countless engineers, scientists, physicists, mathematicians in different locations, how they had to work collectively together to be able to kind of ensure this was going to be a success, requires an enormous commitment. But it actually speaks well to just STEM education. If you look at any of the STEM fields, it kind of gives you an option to say, look, you can have a real big impact in society by being a person that contributes to the overall team. So we kind of refer to these folks as the heroes behind the heroes.
Apollo 11, Houston.
Go ahead.
Roger, we don't want to jettison the hydrogen tank that's stratified, so could you cycle the fans in tank two, please? Hydrogen tank two.
You better believe.
I understand your team had to create some new software to recognize and deal with all the voices that are interacting with each other on these tapes. What exactly did you have to do, and how is that applicable and or of interest to companies who are trying to better understand human speech?
Yeah, so we think today, for example, if you're giving a voice command to your smartphone, let's say if you've got an Apple phone, you're talking to Siri, well, you're giving a voice command. So it's one person speaking to the system, and the recognizer typically will try to identify where silence occurs and where speech occurs. And wherever speech occurs, it's going to extract that and try to recognize what did you say. So this is really the main mode of voice or speech recognition today. If you try to look and think you're giving a voice command to something, your computer or something, if two people are talking over the telephone, well, then you really just have two people talking. If they're behaving and are respectful of each other, they'll take turns talking to each other. So they're not going to overlap on their speech. They'll take turns and give each other space as they're trying to communicate and solve things. When you put teams of people together, on the Apollo tapes here, anywhere from 3 to as many as 35 different people on one track. That means that any one of these people could be talking at the same time. So being able to identify each person as a unique individual and keep them separate is important. And then we could also build what's called a language model. What's the probability of this word followed by the next word? And if you have that language model, that helps correct for any recognition errors because of background noise or speaking differences. You say you're much more likely to say, you know, mission control versus mission patrol, okay? So that means that the acoustics might have said, well, I think the person said patrol, but the language model says, look, it's much more likely they said mission control. So control gets pushed up ahead of patrol. So that means that technologies are now available, and we share that with NASA and be able to help them improve speech recognition going forward on their systems.
What else do you think, I guess, for the rest of us, the non-scientists listening to this, what is there for us to take away from this other than just kind of hearing how things went down?
So you'd say, well, if we could develop technologies that now listen to an audio stream and allows us to separate out all the people that are speaking, we can now say for each individual how many words did each person say over a particular amount of time. We can also look to see who initiated each conversation back and forth. That allows us now to start to document engagement and interaction between people. So imagine the next conference call that you might have, where you may have, you know, 5 to 20 people on that phone, and a meeting takes place for an hour, and you want to be able to kind of get a document that kind of summarizes everything that's going on there. You might say, well, who was speaking then? What were they talking about? How do they accomplish these things? Who might have been the person leading things and trying to ensure consensus? Who was actually trying to be disruptive and trying to, you know, put challenges in there that you may not want to actually include? So you can see that moving forward, these technologies would allow us to actually look at group settings and be able to apply things to group aspects. We've actually been doing that here at the University of Texas at Dallas in our undergraduate education programs. There's a program called Peer-Led Team Learning, where maybe as many as 8 students work together to try and solve math, physics, biology, chemistry problems. So what we've done is we've actually recorded each of those students in these settings and applied the same technology to now analyze how students are working collaboratively to solve calculus problems and see if we can give feedback to both the students as well as the peer-led team learning leaders to give them enforcement to say this person is much more engaged than this person's having challenges with these issues. We can look, for example, at keyword spotting and find, you know, when does this person or when are their challenges or what are the topics that students are asking questions about maybe in this biology class or this chemistry class or this calculus class.
So this is kind of a treasure trove, both for people who are trying to develop and study voice recognition technology, but also for those who are trying to learn how teams work together and solve complicated problems. And of course, I guess landing someone on the moon might be one of the best examples of that in history.
Yeah, absolutely. Yes, yeah.
And what to you personally really stood out from listening to all this material from NASA?
I would say just it was very interesting to hear all of the back people and how they actually worked collaboratively, how they really set aside really all their egos, and you could just see that they were focused. There was no disagreements on things. They really, really understood what they had to do and that the world was looking at them.
Okay, all flight controllers, go, no go for landing. Retro.
Go.
Fido.
Go.
Guidance.
Go.
Control.
Go.
Telcom.
Go.
GNC.
Go.
Ecom.
Go.
Surgeon.
Go.
Capcom, we're go for landing.
Dr. John Hansen of UT Dallas spoke with Houston Matters' Michael Haggerty back in January about archiving NASA's mission control tapes from Apollo. You can learn more at HoustonMatters.org. Just ahead, we welcome your questions about the night sky for astronomer James Wooten from the Houston Museum of Natural Science. Questions about the moon, the stars, planets, meteors, whatever are welcome. The sky is definitely not the limit. Email your astronomy questions to talk@HoustonMatters.org or 713-440-8870 as Houston Matters continues. This month, night sky watchers here in Houston are seeing the planet Mars at its brightest in 15 years. To discuss that and to field your questions about all things astronomical, from Mars to the moon to constellations, meteors, and beyond, we're joined by James Wooten, planetarium astronomer at the Houston Museum of Natural Science. James, welcome to Houston Matters.
Thank you.
And we welcome any questions you have about the night sky at 713-440-8870 or talk@HoustonMatters.org. Let's start with Mars. Why is it so much brighter this month than it's been for the last 15 years?
Well, Earth and Mars both orbit the sun. Earth is closer in, so it goes faster. Think of the faster runner on the inside track. Well, Earth is now passing Mars up. That puts Earth and Mars on the same side of the sun, bringing them very close together, making Mars very bright in our sky. But Mars's orbit is also not a perfect circle. It's an ellipse. So is ours, but ours is closer to being a perfect circle. The point is, it makes a difference. We can pass Mars when Mars is a little bit further away or when Mars is a little bit closer in. So this month, we're passing Mars up on July 27th, actually, and it's when Mars is almost as close as point in.
How often do we pass Mars up?
We pass Mars up every 2 years, 2 months. But this time, we're passing it right when Mars is coming close to the sun as possible. Not exactly, but close. And that's why Mars is so spectacular.
Does this mean that like 6 or 8 years from now, we'll pass Mars when it's as far away as it could be?
That's right. And Mars will still be brighter than usual, but not this spectacular.
All right. So this month, will we need a telescope to see it?
You'll need a telescope to see any features on it. It'll be obvious in the sky. If it's a clear night, you watch it rise in the southeast, kind of reddish. It'll be outshining all the stars. Only Venus will outshine it. Venus will be over in the western sky. So it'll be obvious to look at naked eye, a very bright reddish point of light. if you want to see anything on the surface, you need a telescope to magnify it.
All right. Do you have recommendations on telescopes or particular types you should look for?
Well, I always tell people, if you want to buy a telescope, come out to our George Observatory on any clear Saturday night, and you can see volunteers that will have brought their own telescopes out, a wide variety of telescopes. Look through all those, then you can see exactly what type of telescope does what. And the volunteers will answer all your questions about their own telescope.
You mentioned Venus will be visible in the night sky. Any other planets?
Yes, we have Jupiter and Saturn in the evening sky as well. So we have, for the past couple of months, we've had Venus, Jupiter, and Saturn. Mars will make the fourth one when it appears in the evening sky later on this month.
What are some of the other highlights in the night sky that we can observe during the summer months here in Greater Houston?
Well, see, we have the summer triangle. Three bright stars are in the east, and they're up all night long this time of year. That's why it's called the summer triangle. We also have one of the best meteor showers of the year. Happens every year around August 12th. And so we'll be open Sunday night at the George Observatory, August 12th, into Monday morning, August 13th, to watch the peak night of the Perseid meteor shower.
You ready to take some questions here?
Yes.
Okay, we have a few questions from listeners about black holes.
Sure.
First of all, what is a black hole?
A black hole is the remnant of a very massive star. The star exploded, and the remaining core was so dense that it collapsed, and nothing stopped the collapse, and it formed a singularity we call the black hole.
Do we have any idea how many black holes are in our galaxy? That's one question.
I'm not sure how many there are in the galaxy, but I can tell you that we believe that in the very center of the galaxy is one giant black hole, millions of solar masses. We believe that is true for all the big galaxies like ours.
Michelle asks, what causes a star to collapse into a black hole?
Well, basically, stars are stable because of two forces. Under gravity, all the mass falls to the middle of the star. But stars make all the elements of chemistry. That's what stars are for. That's why those elements exist. And therefore, there's a pressure pushing outward as the mass falls into gravity, and the balance of that keeps the star stable. When the stars burn up all their fuel and stop making new elements, only one force is left at work, that's gravity. Thus, all the mass collapses inward under gravity, and the pressure inside forms a very tight core. The material bounces off of that, rebounds to infinity. That's an explosion called a supernova. If the remnant core is too massive, it will collapse all the way into a black hole.
We have a question from Patrick, who says, in a universe that seems to expand in every which direction, there seems to be a lot of things like solar systems, galaxies, and rings around planets that seem to be relatively flat in nature. Patrick asks, why are there so many planes in non-plane space?
That's because when anything collapses, it tends to flatten out. When anything spins, it tends to flatten out, unless it's rigid. Thus, when these stars form, when these solar systems form, they form from gaseous bodies that would be more spherical at the beginning, but as they spin, they flatten out. And thus, resulting solar systems are often planar.
And I guess the same thing would be with rings around Saturn, for example.
Exactly.
Whatever's causing them to be in orbit around Saturn, those gravitational forces are probably coming from both sides.
Basically,
right?
The solar system nebulae, when it first began, was much more spherical. But as it spun, it flattened out. And therefore, all of the debris, the current solar system, winds up near the same plane as a result.
We have a question from Robert, who asks, when the moon formed, how close was it to Earth and how fast is it moving away from Earth? Is the moon moving away from Earth?
That is correct. And I don't have those numbers in my head. And one rule I learned in teaching, never make numbers up.
Please, that's good. That's a good rule
of
thumb.
But the concept is correct. The moon was much closer into to the Earth when it formed, and it moves outward because it de-spins the Earth. The same side of the moon faces the Earth all the time because Earth has de-spun the moon until that happened. The moon does the same thing to the Earth, but the moon is smaller, so it takes much longer. Earth is slowing down its rotation, and that energy goes to the moon, raising it to a higher orbit. Very slowly, though, only, I want to say, about a centimeter or a millimeter a year. A very, very slow effect. You won't notice that much of a difference in your lifetime, basically. But when the dinosaurs were on the Earth, the day was 21 hours long, mm-hmm. 24, something like that. And so the Earth has been slowing down its spin. The moon's been gaining that energy. and getting a little bit higher, a little bit further from the Earth over time.
This is Houston Matters. I'm Craig Cohen. We're talking with James Wooten, planetarium astronomer with the Houston Museum of Natural Science. We're fielding your questions about the night sky, anything you want to know about stars and comets, moons and planets. Email us at talk@houstonmatters.org or call 713-440-8870. We have a question. Why do galaxies rotate?
Well, galaxies rotate because the original group of stars that formed them was rotating. You have to remember that things, if something's spinning, nothing will stop it. It will spin forever. See, on the Earth, we look at things to spin, they stop because there are frictional forces down here which stop things from spinning. In space, no such forces exist. The spin tends to be conserved.
This is the Newton rule. An object in motion will stay in motion unless acted upon by an opposing force, and there is no opposing force. It just keeps going.
That's correct. That's the same reason all the planets orbit the sun in the same direction. That's the original spin of the solar nebula conserved. And the same thing is with the galaxy. The original object that formed the galaxy was spinning. Often galaxies are formed, big ones can be formed by collisions, and the collision, if it's a glancing blow, will spin up the galaxy, and that spin will be conserved as the galaxy's rotation.
And another question, if the universe began with a singularity, how can galaxies be colliding? Aren't they all traveling away from the singularity? How do some decide to turn and collide?
You have to remember that there's no center of the expansion of the universe. The expansion of the universe is that there's just more space everywhere all the time. It's a difficult concept to appreciate because we're used to things expanding and filling a larger space, creating a center of the expansion. But the expansion of the universe is the expansion of all space all the time. There's no center of the expansion. And the expansion happens at such a large scale that galaxies are kind of like points.
And they
form structures of filaments in space. So basically the galaxies are all moving away from each other, but there can be groups of galaxies bound together under their own gravity.
So if I'm understanding correctly, and I'm going to try and visualize this, imagine at one point the universe was the size of a super ball, and then it became the size of a baseball. But the space that's all around the super ball, the space all around the baseball, there was no space there. Nothing existed there.
That's correct. All of space and time begins with the Big Bang. And the key concept is that the expansion of the galaxies isn't the galaxies moving through space away from each other. It's that there's more space everywhere all the time, which moves the galaxies further apart.
Are there particular areas of greater Houston or within a short drive of Houston that you recommend traveling to in order to get your best look at the night sky?
Well, that's why our George Observatory is in Brazos Bend State Park. Again, that's not ideal because Houston is still too close. An hour's drive southwest in town is where the park is. And you want to be in the middle of nowhere to get a look at the sky. But for being in the Houston area and easy to drive to, the George Observatory, open all clear Saturday nights to the public, is what I recommend. Of course, real observatories aren't anywhere near any big city. So, for example, UT operates the McDonald Observatory out near Fort Davis. If you've ever driven through West Texas, there's nothing over there. There's nothing over there, which is why you put it there. There's nothing anywhere close to it. And that's where you want to go to really look at the sky.
James Wooten is planetarium astronomer at the Houston Museum of Natural Science. James, thanks very much.
You're welcome.
I'm Lynn Marie Garcy. I'm a licensed private investigator mitigation specialist. I am also a quilt designer, and I write books. I guess one of my passions is I enjoy helping defendants, the underdog, and you gotta help them. In the investigation field, I deal with mainly criminal defense, working with capital murder, death penalty, murder, and sexual assault. I also do some work down in Mexico. I have been to Denmark. I have been to Spain, I've been to The Hague, doing my job as a private investigator. And as of this, I am also working on my master's degree in forensic psychology. In my quilting end of it, I design quilts. I make a lot of red, white, and blue quilts. And for a while, we were giving them to the mothers of the soldiers who were killed in Afghanistan. A quilt is something that you give that wraps around them, and that's your arms giving them a hug. So when I do give a quilt, I'm giving a part of me, and I'm giving a love part of me as well. I'm Lynn Marie Garcia. I'm a licensed private investigator mitigation specialist, a writer. I am also a quilt designer, and you're listening to Houston Matters.
You may on occasion catch writer W.F. Strong sharing one of his stories from Texas on the Texas Standard, the statewide public radio show that we air weekday mornings at 10 here on News 88.7. Well, he's collected some of them for a new book. Our own Michael Haggerty's here with more. Hi, Michael.
Hey, Craig.
The book's called Stories from Texas. Some of them are true. Some of them?
Yeah. Well, some of the book features larger-than-life personalities from Texas history, and let's face it, some of those tales can sometimes grow a bit tall in the telling, but he also writes about how Texans talk. There's even a bit in there about Houston, specifically the over-the-top opulence of the long-departed Shamrock Hotel. And he starts the book with some memorable quotes about Texas.
Well, one of my favorites, and I think it seems to be the favorite of many, many people in Texas, is the Steinbeck quote about Texas is a state of mind and it is virtually a religion. That Texans love Texas. And so anything that is a celebration of the Texas character or Texas culture, Texans have an interest in.
Plenty of states have state pride and civic pride, but
sure.
Texas seems to have more. Am I right about that, and why?
I think Texas has more because we have a long heritage of a Texas pride. You know, ever since the Alamo, that pride has only grown, really. And then you have, if we go with Steinbeck's idea that Texas pride is a kind of religion, you can find it in the symbology of Texas that all Texans seem to display, like a religion almost. You drive through any neighborhood, you can't go past three or four houses without seeing the Texas star on the side of a house or the Texas flag, or you'll be driving down a country road and there'll be just this lone Texas flag out there in front of the house. Many, many houses have Texas flags. And on barns, very popular on barns. You can't drive through Oregon and see the Oregon flag on an Oregon barn.
Right.
You don't see it in Kansas. I think the only place in America that has this kind of intensive pride, and it's in a smaller region, is New York City.
I've always thought this had this theory that probably nothing original, but that Texas is the most American state, or this perfect microcosm of America as a whole, in that it's diverse in its landforms, its people. There's beach, there's ocean, there's plains, there's desert, but there's all kinds of people. And we had to fight for our independence just like America did, and all these things that are, and we're very proud of our state or of our former country that it was. And so it mimics America as a whole in a lot of ways.
Oh, I think you're absolutely right. I think that is a brilliant observation, because Texas is to the United States what the United States is to the world, in a sense. You know, we are a microcosmic version of that with our own unique history. And I like what the great historian Fehrenbach said. He said that Texas history is 1/4 of American history. And that's why we're so significant in the history of the United States, because so much that happened here affected, you know, the rest of the country. I call myself a Texologist because I've always maintained a fascination not only with Texas history, but Texas literature. You know, to be a culture, you've got to have your own literature, you've got to have your own food, you've got to have your own language or dialect, and your own music. So we have all these things, your own clothes, your own style of dress, and we have all of these things. We are a culture.
The dialect, you write about that a decent amount in the early parts of the book. That's Texas diphthong specifically. What is that for the unacquainted?
Well, the diphthong is where you take a one-syllable word and you make a two-syllable word out of it. So take a word, a very simple word like jet. In Texas, a lot of people use a diphthong. They say jet. That one-syllable word becomes a two-syllable word. I took a jet up to Dallas. And so we have this tendency to stretch things out, to elongate the consonants and stretch out the vowels. That's why we're slower talkers, you see. And the diphthong is interesting. I had a woman write to me. I love this. She said, when my son was born, I gave him a good, solid, two-syllable Texas name. I named him Ben.
Yikes. Drag that out. Yeah, I moved to Texas when I was in middle school age, and originally kind of it resisted things like y'all and fixin' to, which I still kind of resisted. But my wife is a native Texan, native Houstonian, and we've had this debate, and she's brought me around on the term y'all, because you know, it's just easy to just feel like, oh, that's how Hicks talk or something. But but she's like, you know, it's more specific. It's it's quicker. It's a quicker path to understanding, saying all of you, say just y'all, you all.
Or all y'all. That's the plural of y'all is all y'all.
If I'm saying I'm going to dinner with you, we'd have to say, well, which you?
Which you?
Him, him, you, her. And do a head count. But
yeah, it's beautifully inclusive.
Y'all means, I guess that means everyone. And then, of course, then there's the all y'all, which is even better, which is the super inclusive.
You get 5,000 people. All y'all. All y'all come over to dinner tonight.
So I see some of its like its usefulness, I guess. She's warm me down on that.
I call it linguistic efficiency.
Yeah.
So you take something like the possessive of y'alls is y'allses. So y'all are going to have to move all y'all's trucks out there.
Well, I haven't heard that as much.
Y'all's. And, yeah, well, go to East Texas. You'll hear it. And y'all'd have. You all would have. Y'all'd have. Y'all'd have loved it if y'all'd have come. So you have that's a contraction that has three apostrophes in it. Four words reduced down to one. Y'all, you all would have reduced to one word. Y'all'd have. So, that, well, that's one of the things that's fun about a dialect is it's you know, you're just playing with language. You're creating a more efficient description or use of verbiage according to what your culture requires.
This is Houston Matters. I'm Michael Haggerty. I'm talking with writer W.F. Strong, whose segment Stories from Texas is heard on public radio stations across the state, and he's got a book called Stories from Texas. Some of them are true. You write about how we in Texas, of course, love to marvel about the size of our state, how you can drive 800-something miles from, you know, Beaumont to El Paso and still be in the same state. A lot of us remember, of course, Texas was a lot bigger
back
in the day and had this unusual shape and the real long with the stovepipe shape that was like more than a panhandle that went way up into like Wyoming.
Wyoming, right.
And I just hadn't really thought about it, but there's a lot of things that we know today associate with other states that used to be Texas.
Yes. We used to own half of New Mexico, about a quarter of Colorado, and actually the really good part of Colorado.
Like and, Vail used to be Texas.
Yeah. And, all the way up into southern Wyoming. You can go up there to southern Wyoming, you'll still find things named Texas Creek. So the history of its existence is written in the names of things up there, you might say. Even the panhandle of Oklahoma was part of Texas, and one of those counties in the panhandle of Oklahoma is called Texas County. So we still have a presence, you know, in those. But the sad thing is that we sold it all for $10 million. Of course, we had to. We were very poor. We needed the money. We were land poor, big time. And so we sold it for $10 million, about 6 cents an acre, you know, real, real cheap. And it hurts me to this day because, you know, just a basic, really nice mansion in Vail will be $10 million. So historically, we sold out really cheap. But the good news is that we got a much better shape. The old shape wouldn't have fit on a T-shirt, but we have a great shape for a T-shirt. So it helps with marketing.
What do you enjoy so much about getting to tell stories from Texas?
I like to say that Texans have a great deal of pride in Texas, but I feel like sometimes they don't know perhaps all the reasons that that pride is justified. For instance, one of the things that I know is a lot of people aren't familiar with the Texas literary history. You know, we have beautiful writers and McCarthy and McMurtry and great columnists like Leon Hale. And, you know, we just have this wonderful literature that isn't known, not the way it should be, I think. So when I started this, I just really wanted to pluck out beautiful passages from things like Elmer Kelton's The Time It Never Rained and share them on the radio and hopefully inspire people, perhaps seduce them into saying, I want to read that book. You know, that's great. I must read that. And so I'm always trying to get people who love Lonesome Dove to read Lonesome Dove, the book. I mean, the miniseries is fabulous. It's fantastic. Probably the best miniseries ever in terms of its loyalty to the book. But still, the book is even more magnificent. And then a lot of people don't know that there's three more.
So you start off trying to get more people, draw people to the stories about Texas, stories from Texas, but then ended up telling some new ones yourself.
That's right.
Well, thank you so much for taking time to talk with me.
Appreciate your time.
Writer W.F. Strong's new book is Stories from Texas. Some of them are true. He spoke with Houston Matters' Michael Haggerty. And that'll do it for today's show. The Houston Matters team includes Michael Haggerty, Maggie Martin, Abner Fletcher, and Joshua Zinn. We had help today from Allison Lee and Brenda Ruiz. Tom Carter's our technical director. On tomorrow's show, will the next U.S. Supreme Court justice actually affect abortion rights, or is that concern overblown? We ask a constitutional law professor and a political scientist. Also, the good, the bad, and the ugly of the week's news. And Houston actor Tamari Cooper talks with Houston Public Media's Ernie Manous about her annual musical comedy show. I'm Craig Cohen. Join us tomorrow for those and other Houston Matters.
Houston Public Media.